my privilege to conclude this morning's comments by introducing our final speaker, who is probably the most successful, most well-known, and most difficult to achieve final quality. She may also be one of the most liked debate judges in America. You can be successful, and you can have longevity in the activity, but it's hard to do both those and remain popular among students, judges, faculty, and ancient forensic dinosaurs alike. Melissa Maxie Wade is the Director of Forensics at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia, where she directs the Barclay Forum, a dynamic debate program that focuses on competition at the national level, and in that they are probably the most successful college debate program in America. But the Barclay Forum is also about community outreach, about personal development, and about working to make the world a better place by trying to help us all become better people within that world. I believe the Barclay Forum is successful in those goals. It's making a lot of progress, and I think it's because, in many ways, of its director. Please welcome one of America's great lecturers, Melissa Maxie Wade.
When you give me the last rebuttal, it's a dangerous thing. I usually speak first for a variety of reasons, lest I, since I usually schedule them, be accused of hoarding the last rebuttal. So I'm not usually in this spot, and I would like to begin by making two observations. One is that Larry Moss just told you how to teach. He told you that people were vulnerable. He told you that they were tough. He told you that they would not share those with you. And then he told you an absurd story about himself, suited up in a Claremont men's jacket with a pipe and a Latin book upside down as he got off of the bus, as though he had read it. He just taught you about how to share about yourself in an appropriate way. I learned an enormous amount about coaching debate when I had a two-year-old. Because I learned, first of all, that unless you let a child fall down and skin their knee, they will not learn to respect concrete. And I also learned that they love to hear about how you messed up. And most parents don't understand that. This is an opinion I hold after coaching for 1,000 years. Most parents believe that if they tell their child they were perfect, that the child would aspire to be perfect. And since that is not possible and will inevitably fail, the greatest gift we can sometimes give is to talk about ourselves. Tuna talks about stories about himself and how he was not a student. He's one of the most prominent scholars in our field. He is an articulate speaker. He entertains. He stood up and told you how to be when you gave a lecture. He told you to be dynamic and entertaining, and then he showed you how to do it. Now, the danger is that we were all down the stupid ones, and we were also very, very insecure when we were in public speaking settings. We're so old now, and our skins are so thick that we know how to do this because we've been messing up for a long time, and we learned to cover our errors. You will be learning that, and that's a lot about what I'm going to talk about today. I want to talk about power and proxy wars and teaching, and what I hope is the death of the concept of diversity training. Oh dear, she's going to start with Cherokee. This is a bad thing. I don't know about this. I want to start by declaring diversity training dead. And Larry gave me a beautiful lead-in. Diversity training cannot be conducted by lecture. It trivializes the very concept of human respect to assume that I can teach you about that in a lecture format. The existence of diversity training masks our resolve to push forward to experiences which will heighten our awareness of our seemingly infinite capacity for prejudice and blame assignment. You see, we don't want it to be our fault, and we don't want to take responsibility. Diversity training appeals too easily to our egos, to to our capacity for self-righteousness, for feeling good about ourselves, and finding a place in which we can be affirmed because of our inherent goodness. Diversity training, I'm afraid, increases the divide between those who have been declared sensitive to difference by such training and those who are cads and ignorant because they do not know how to behave. All of us have told you that we've learned from you. We've learned from students. We had an interesting conversation yesterday because Tuna said, be careful about touching. Don't touch. Renee Jackson taught me at the Emory Institute that touching is terribly important for a lot of students who've never been touched by a teacher before, and for students of color, certainly not by white teachers. Last night at dinner, John Meany, as we continued this conversation, I encouraged Renee to talk to Tuna because Tuna would be very open and receptive to this, and John Meany said, I never touched a student, and John Meany is one of my total heroes in the way he conducts himself. He said, because it's just too dangerous. Now, if they initiate it, it's okay. And it instantly dawned on me there was a very big difference between male touching and female touching. And if I looked like some of you, if I was a director of debate like Sarah Ryan, and I went around hugging my boys, there might be some eyebrows raised. I can get away with a, wah-ha-ha-ha, it's at my age. You see, when you look like someone's mother, you can hug them. And most of us don't have enough hugging in our life, I believe, this firmly and sincerely. And there are those of you who would dispute me. But obviously, there are different dimensions, and our experiences are different. I've learned that students are receptive to hugging. They need it. Tuna and John and Larry will have to be careful about that. Betty and I have been doing it since the beginning of time. We don't know how to talk to people without touching them. So our realities can be different in this culture across many lines. And part of those lines that haven't been addressed, I want to talk a little bit about today, is across gender lines, but also across age lines. There are some things we can get away with if we have great authority. We see an age, and we walk ponderously, with great importance you see, and people flock to us because we have great wisdom. And I want to talk to you about power. But first of all, I want to notice that diversity training was such a wonderful idea in the beginning because we just had to start somewhere. But as with all ideas, they have their day and we need to move on. I love the urban debate league concept. And I think the thing I'm the most excited about this year is how far it has moved. It's not just in a bunch of different cities. It's taking a completely new form in Pittsburgh, where Gordon Mitchell is taking teachers in the elementary schools and teaching them how to use debate in the curriculum. And he's going into the middle schools and doing the same thing. I love the idea of debate across the curriculum. I love what Eric is doing with alternative schools in Providence. We're very interested in doing that in Georgia. There is so much you can use an urban debate league as a jumping off point into the full curriculum of the school. We're debating education. And any good pilot project is not something that masks change and reform. A good pilot project is a seed that's going to grow a whole bunch of different programs. And I will never stand and defend urban debate links. It's the only way to bring change into debate. What's good about them is that they grow and they give us something new. In any human striving, we can take a good idea and turn it into something that will lead to human disrespect. We just have this little problem. And our problem is that we are individual creatures. We cannot meld with one another. I always did Mr. Spock. The one gift I wish I could give so many of my students is if they could get inside my head and for just 10 seconds see themselves the way I see them. Not with potential that shackles them because they're not living up to it, but as just wonderful human beings. And we are so busy being critical of people. We are very quick to judge. We learn that from our parents. Sit up straight, use your forthright, put your napkin in your lap, whatever. And we learn very quickly that what we do that is good is not usually affirmed, but what we do that is bad is noticed. As Shakespeare said, there is nothing which is good nor bad that the mind does not make it so. And from teachers to parents to friends, we learn to be critical. And we learn that affirmation is not the appropriate route. And being critical inevitably leads to disrespect. We try to teach about difference in diversity training. What happens? We create another category where we're better than someone else. We get in front of the classroom, a student says something absolutely, profoundly hateful and disrespectful, and to them, it's just normal language. Should we publicly ridicule them for inappropriate speech because they haven't had diversity training and they don't know what all the right words to use are? Or should we understand how that phrase left from that child's lips? And try to understand that teaching is what is involved. And teaching is what we're about. Well, listen, what are we supposed to do? This is one of those critique things, isn't it? You know, we're just going to say this system isn't working and we've got nothing to complain. Of course not. In my infinite wisdom, I have vision about everything. And if people would just put me in charge, I'm sure I could fix the world. Unfortunately, that's probably not going to happen. So I think that we have to begin to deconstruct what we do with communication and education about difference. And I think that we need to look at the underlying causes of our problems in communication across all human communities. Rich, old, black, white, in whatever ethnic, religious background differences we have, all across the spectrum of difference, we need to understand there's an underlying human respect. I love it when Tuna says it's so easy to talk about our differences, but underneath, we're one blood. We all bleed the same blood. We have some stunning human similarities. And the bottom line, folks, is the heart of disrespect is fear. The heart of disrespect is fear. The first step in deconstruction is to look at that fear. You might call that looking at the elimination of proxy wars. And from there to understand what our power is as human beings and as teachers. And while I'm going to focus on the teaching role in this institute, I think it's very important to amplify what Larry and Tuna have both said. This is about people's lives. A lot of my professional peers, the first 10 years of my coaching, very much laughed at the way I coached. You see, I didn't cut 400,000 cards, write all my students' arguments, tell them what order to read them in, and then claim the victory when they got the trophy. That's how I saw what they did. I understood it as something that was about people's lives and having a voice, and that was very different. What's a proxy war? Well, in foreign policy, it'll be in future college debaters in America. You'll be learning that it's when two or more competitive nations support opposing sides in a smaller conflict. There's some benefits to that. We don't have to confront each other directly. It doesn't cost us as much money. It often yields prestige for us so that we can increase our hegemonic reach in a particular area we are focused. Proxy wars don't just exist, however, in foreign policy. Vietnam was a proxy war. Russia and China and the United States all had a big old fight by fueling one side of that conflict over another. And it was just a terrible day when America had to pull out. The whole group of people that saw it as America losing a war. And we did lose people, and we did lose material. But it was a drop in the bucket compared to what a full-out nuclear exchange would have been. And so we fought a proxy war. We did the same thing in human relations. One thought it was a small issue to fight about, to express frustration with another about a larger issue. Almost every one of you has had proxy wars with one or both of your parents. Parents, well, families, in my opinion, are part of proxy wars. And this is the way it works. Kid fails the class. Parent doesn't come down very hard on the kid for failing the class, but really accelerates their yelling at them about how messy their room is. Or they left their shoes in the kitchen for people to trip over. And all at once, there's an escalation of all these little wars in the family. And what's the heart of those? The real issue is that no one's communicating about the academic failure. What happened here? If there was an expectation of the family that they passed a certain class, or that a certain standard of academic achievement is required, and we're not talking about it, we're talking about shoes on the floor, and we're not communicating. Why? Because of fear. And there's fear on both sides. Fear on the side of the parent is they're afraid kids' failure is their responsibility. And it scares them. They don't want to be responsible for their child's failure. They brought this child into the world, and they know that child, and they have to be there. There are certain minimum social requirements of families. Now, we can be all nice on the outside and go home and be mean to each other. We had a bad day, we can't get a piece of cat, you see, that's okay, we had a bad day. And we have to be nice to the people at work, and we have to be nice to some other social, significantly others, but we can take our families pretty well for granted. And the bottom line is, we don't want to be responsible for our children's failures, so we fight a proxy war with them and we yell at them about their shoes. The child is afraid, and in many cases terrified, they're going to grow up to be just like their parents. This is a way down, shove down, the fear. And we especially don't want to be the worst of our parents. The problem is both choose to avoid acknowledging this reality and fight proxy wars instead. But they can't fully shove the fear down. It bubbles up in other places. And we fight other little battles. We're passive aggressive, that's the current, you know, language of psychology here, you know. We're passive aggressive. We start fighting about something that's not what the real fight about. That's what a proxy war is. Now, this is bad, but it's fundamentally disrespectful, folks. Parents have a problem by not discussing with the child, further increasing the child's insecurity. Because they don't ever talk about it. So the child just feels rotten, doesn't really know how to cope with it. The child compounds the problem because withholding the judgment of the parent to the parent prevents the kind of dialogue that might help them understand better that the parent has fears too. And the mutual judgment that goes on with all these unspoken fears down here is all about proxy wars. It's both disrespectful. In the land of relationships, most of you have been to this. You find someone, you fall in love, it's all heavy, it's just terrific, you can't eat, you can't sleep, you just walk around knowing that the world is a better place because you have found love. Over time, the courting behavior stops, they start taking you for granted, you get a little unhappy with one another, and all at once you notice that their nose is really big. And they just keep being attracted to you. You fall out of love because the real person is surface and you just flat don't like it. Now, unfortunately, this is sometimes unrequited. They do not always dislike you at the same time. In fact, they may be so in love with the idea of being in love that they don't even notice that you don't like them anymore. And so this is what you decide. This poor, pathetic person cannot hear the real truth that I don't love them anymore, so I'll just tell them, we need to break up, but it's about me. It's not really about you. It's about my weaknesses and limitations. In fact, my immaturity is so, I just can't sustain relationships. I'm not responsible. That's it. I'm just not a responsible person. I think that that is the height of disrespect. It is so paternalistic to make a judgment that you know how another feels, that they cannot take the truth. And we disrespect each other all the time. We don't tell a teacher that we thought their lecture was terrible because we're afraid of what they would do in terms of having a grade. We have so much disrespect in this culture, it is unbelievable. But it's still there, and we fight proxy wars. So you disrespect your significant other. You don't tell them that their nose is too big all of a sudden. And you just can't even look at it one more minute. Or whatever it is about that is bothering you. So you fight the proxy wars. I want my CD back. And we'll have a big fight about the CD and whether it's even any good to begin with. Well, that's not about that. That's about why can't you be honest with me and tell me what's up? And a lot of times these are gender assigned roles. The man is the one who gets away with culturally constructed, it's okay, see, I'm a guy. Guys are irresponsible, we're tacky, marriage exists to tie us down. See, if there wasn't a law that said we have to stay at home with you, we would not do it because you see, we're just inherently immature, wandering creatures. That's just about what we are. And women go, tell me the truth now, don't give me that garbage. I want to know what's wrong with me that you're focusing on. And the, you know the reality? We don't want to know. We don't want to know. But you see, we're so sure they're not going to tell us that we've got this martyr role, see here, and then we can all be that's the worst problem. But you know what? It's all about disrespect, ladies and gentlemen. It's about paternalism and disrespect. And I think that we need to eliminate proxy wars if we're going to get to understand our fear and what motivates us in the ways that we are motivated to disrespect one another. How does it work in a debate teaching setting? It's based on fear, the proxy wars inside in our groups, in our labs, in our interactions with students, and there's three examples of we do. I could probably add 15 more. I'm bad about talking too long, so I'll just give you three. First is that we feel insecure about ourselves as teachers. We're not really sure what we're doing. Hear all these lectures, sounds good. Got a list from Larry, got a list from Tim, you're going to get a list from me. You know, we're just impulsive, linear thinkers, we're all Cartesian. And so we're going to give you lists, and you're going to walk in with your list, and some of you are physically writing this down, and some of you are just like this, oh God, this is hour three. But you got lists. You don't really have to go with the flow here. You can just write it down and think about it later. But you're going to get in the teaching setting and see it's just not going to work like that. I know that everything I have ever learned, I learned from making a mistake. And the mistake was big enough that I resolved not to do that anymore. And the way that I discuss it as college coach and teacher is, there is a child's body in the closet of my life with the name of a lesson on it. And the way I pay that child back is by not screwing up other children with that mistake. Therefore, folks, mistakes are our teachers. They are our greatest teachers. They are not statements of our worth about you as human beings. Oh, we made a mistake. That's what your parents say. We are not parents in this situation. We are being teachers, and we need to understand that mistakes are our greatest teachers. So we feel insecure about ourselves as teachers, and you know what we do about that? We promote a lot of times conflict with our teaching partner. And then we solve that conflict, see, and we look at it because we know how to create conflict. We have been a debater, and we have had a partner. And most of us have had partners that we thought had brains the size of a pea, who were certainly beneath us in our skill level, who we had to carry through everything, and then explain and clean up after it's all over with the judge so that they won't hold it against us that we have to debate with a pathetic person. And so we know how to create conflict. We know a lot about blame assignment. We know how to solve it publicly because we've done that with the judge, so it's a real easy, natural thing to do, especially when you're in teaching pairs. Because no two people always agree. And I loved what Tim has said. He's given you two very important lessons that I want to underscore. One is that you are role modeling conflict resolution with your students, with each other. And the second thing is that you can criticize. The next words out of your mouth better be proposed solutions. And that's how you solve this, but folks, this is the proxy war we get invited into when we are insecure about our teaching. We assume our teaching partner is better than we are, or we take on the role of the inferior in the group. Usually this is an age thing. The older person has the power, the younger person goes and gets the teacher and coach to the group. But it doesn't have to be that way. It can be male, female. And there are so many ways to take our differences and turn them into fears that then get translated into proxy wars that ruin the experience for students who are in the process of trying to get something from you at a far deeper level than how one would go about constructing a solitude intention. Second kind of proxy war we fight is we feel judged by the student because of our difference, race, gender, sexual preference, whatever. And we fight proxy wars to combat that perception by being overly critical of their evidence, arguments, instruction, public performance. We create a problem with the student in order to solve it. Now, I very much like what Larry said. He has prepared you to deal with students who have had different experiences from you. And he has also cautioned those of you who have had similar experiences about what your obligations are. And then he shows you how to do it. You don't do it by being overcritical, dictatorial, a martinet, full authority. You do it by sharing your own weaknesses, your own learning curve of debate. And most of us, because we feel insecure about our teaching role, the way we compensate is credibility, see? We go, well, if you see, I want this, 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 and this, and I never lose on the affirmative, and I'm a really good critique debater. We promote our own credibility. This is Ethan, so there it goes. Larry stands up and goes, oh, I'm sandwiched between Melissa and Tina, you know, they're communication experts, blah, blah, blah. And then he proceeds to blow everybody in the room away and give a standing ovation. He didn't stand up and say, I'm an expert on everything. I know all about African American children, the predominant populations you're going to be dealing with. The example at the end is about Latino children. Are you paying attention? He showed you how to do it. You don't do it by telling them how great you are. They will see through that so quickly. If you have to tell me how good you are, I assume there's something wrong with you. So he shows you how to get out of this proxy war if you feel judged by a student. Third example of proxy wars, we feel insecure about the judgment of dinosaurs. And this is a big bad. Tuna and John, Meany and Steve Woods are so impressive, and they're going to judge us, and we care what they think, and we want to impress them. And so if we feel insecure about our teaching and our ability to implement the suggestions that they have given during the last 2 days, then we'll create a conflict in our group that we can solve so we can go to them and say, see, I solved this problem just like you said. That's not what Tuna said. Tuna said, when conflict arises or things are not going the way you think they should be going, find a solution. Don't just be critical. But if your agenda is to talk to Tuna about how your partner just isn't living up to the list he gave you of how to teach, or to Steve to say everything Larry said they're just not getting, we all hear things in different ways. We're human beings. Words are imprecise and are taken out of context on a regular basis. And the reason we talk behind each other's backs and we play proxy wars is because we are not taught in this culture to be honest. And Larry just gave you a really fine set of reasons why we're not honest. Those of us with privilege do not want to believe we had anything to do with those who are deprived. We don't want to know. We sit behind our little middle-class walls, and we don't want to look over those walls. And when we do, we feel good about ourselves, because see, we can go impress Tuna. Or we can go impress Larry. That's another form of proxy wars. The bottom line is, in the morning you have to get up and look at yourself in the mirror. And you have to decide if you did right. Does that mean you're going to not screw up? No, you're going to screw up. You're going to screw up daily. I screw up daily. But what you have to do is decide, have I taken the appropriate action to deal with that? If you feel guilty about something, you probably haven't learned the lesson, and you're probably going to repeat it. If you regret, that means you probably learned the lesson. and you will pay back the child who made the mistake on by not doing it again, or the co-teacher, or the institute leader, or whatever. But we've got to eliminate proxy wars if we're going to get to respect, which is what this is all about. Human beings understanding that they are of one blood. We are siblings in the human family. And instead of treating it like we're siblings at home, it's very different because the bad end of the gene pool is very clear. It's all located. He disturbed my brother. You know, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about respecting each other as siblings in the human family. And part of that is sharing our story. A story I love to use with high school kids was the first acceptance speech I ever gave when I was 13 years old. And I got to go into high school kids without being a good eighth grader. They let three of us go to high school tournament to accept. The baby tells we're supposed to have files. And I had never done one before. And I had skipped a grade along the way, you know, so smart. And my topic was birth control. I really didn't know what that was. I'm not making this up. So one of the older kids felt sorry for me and gave me a one-page Time magazine article that argued in favor of birth control to control world population. My topic was about the United States. And I translated that information totally inappropriately, and guess what? I had a nun from the Catholic Forensic in the back of the room. I know you think I'm making this up. This was in Houston, Texas, and I'm not making it up. I was raised Southern Baptist. It is something I think critically about, as I will share with you a little later on one of these issues I'm going to talk about, as Larry assessed. But I didn't know the Catholic Church had a position on birth control. And the position I was waxing eloquent about certainly was not hers. Now, she could have been real mean to me and let me have it. Then she saw a 12-year-old who clearly didn't understand birth control was taking the wrong side in front of a Catholic nun. Now, she was real nice, and after this was over, she sat down and spoke with me about extent, preparation, understanding two sides to a topic, reading newspapers, becoming more informed. Never said a word about the Catholic Church. I found that out later, much to my great embarrassment. But we all have situations where we have made perfect fools of ourselves in competition. Every last one of us, if we have ever been in competition, has made a perfect fool of ourselves. Share that with them. See, that's real stuff. And that's what Larry's talking about, being real. He shared with you. Tuna has shared with you. I'm going to continue sharing this. But that's the best way to do it. Remember that when you're a parent, too. Works real a whole lot better. Okay. I think there are three steps to eliminating proxy wars. Step number one is knowing your power. Knowing your power. And you're sitting here thinking, oh, great, I have a lot of power here. You have more power than any of the dinosaurs. You have more power than Susie, Tuna, Larry, and Betty put together. Because you're young and cool. Justine will sing this song for you later. You are young and cool. You have torn jeans. You have multiple body piercings. You have cool hair. You represent all kinds of things that are closer to your age than we are. And they will want to be like you, which is why you have to be a role model for good behavior. They will want to be like you, but you're not going to feel powerful because you don't feel like you exactly know what you're doing. Some of you are young looking and have a lot of teaching experience. I don't think I ever stopped learning about teaching. I learned some from Renee less than a month ago. And she wasn't the only one. The point is, we're always insecure in some settings. We're infinitely capable of saying stupid things. But the fact that we do have power is proved by the fact that, A, you showed up. Woody Allen says 80% of life is showing up. You showed up. You cared enough to show up. Two, you came prepared. Those of you who are white teaching people of color, you have some power there. Larry was describing that for you. You're alien. You are people who judge. You got all the marbles. Why are you here teaching me? There is power in that situation. I'm not using the word power to mean always good. You hearing that? Power is something you hold by virtue of standing in front of a group of people and having any kind of exchange with them. You have it. You need to know it. And you need to use it wisely. Those of you who are people of color, you don't have much power. Since you made it, you're on a teaching faculty here at the World Faith Institute. And you legitimize all the white people, see? You do. Be up front here. And the bottom line is, none of us can appropriate the experience of a person of color. You can't know what that means. I can't begin to understand what Betty's life was like. Nor can she understand mine. But we can try to find some metaphors across which we can talk. One of those that I know is buying a car. I'm a female. When I go buy a car with my husband, they tell him about fuel economy and engine design, and then they look at me and go, ma'am, what color would you like? I've heard African-American and Latino people tell me that they feel invisible. I know how that feels because I've been a woman standing next to a man buying a car. So I can't know what it's like for Betty, but we can talk about what it's like to feel invisible. And so there are bridges. There are bridges that we can have. We decided at the Emory Institute this year that we were going to name our novice, JV, and advanced level folks after animals. So we made names of sharks and lions and wolves and bears and whatever. And it said, oh my, that's what I did. And I'm sitting here with another black faculty member doing this, and I go, uh-oh, we need to check in with Eddie Warner and find out if we're giving gang names to people. And so I called Eddie, and I go, I have a really stupid white person question. Am I doing something wrong here? You know, I'm the kind of person they give those stone things, like on The Simpsons, you know, you say something profane with somebody's name. My students do this all the time to me because I'm dumb and I read them and don't even hear what I'm saying. They're the bathroom human back here. You have power. Use it wisely. No, you haven't. By the way, prejudice exists because of power. And every one of you can understand that if you've had a sibling. Because you need to be better than them, different from them, unique from them. And have your parents' full attention at the expense of theirs. Most of you, if you really got those parents' full attention, wouldn't want, but you think you want. And most of us never get over being 8 years old, folks. When you're 8 years old, your parent is just a pile of power. Because their legs are long enough to drive, and they can eat ice cream whenever they want. And we never quite get over that. And we never quite get over middle school when everything on our body changes. And things start growing and moving and hair is coming out, everything's awful. And so we have this image of ourselves as inconsequential middle school people. Now virtually everybody in this room is over 20, but we still think of ourselves as 14. We need to get over that and understand that we have power. Step number two. It's understanding that traditional educational methods are flawed. Traditional educational methods are flawed. This is the academic part. Now, Tim is a communication professor, and Larry is a political science professor, and I'm an educational studies professor. So I come at this from a little bit different angle. I'm going to say some of the same things that they've said. But one of the things that I'm getting ready to totally violate, and they were at least consistent by showing you how to do it, I'm going to totally violate mine, and that is that we need to understand that education is horribly, fundamentally flawed. And I'm a big, big, big follower and teach a lot of the work of Paulo Freire, however, I'm terrible with that. In any event, he says, education is terribly flawed. And I want to just read you a couple of cards from him, because this will profoundly impact your curriculum in my view. The first thing he says is that education suffers from narration sickness. Number two, he says, their brains are not a big bag you deposit stuff in. That's Freire. That's what Freire is saying. And this is a quote from him. The content of narration by teachers, whether values or empirical dimensions of reality, tend in the process of being narrated to become lifeless and petrified. Education is suffering from narration sickness. The teacher talks about reality as if it were motionless, static, compartmentalized, and predictable, or else he expounds on a topic completely alien to the existential experience of the student. His task is to fill the student with the content of narration, which becomes alienating. Lectures are bad. Lectures are bad. Second thing he says, the result of this is that students become objectified and dehumanized. While students do have the opportunity to become collectors or catalogers of the things they store, in the last analysis, it is the people themselves who are filed away through lack of creativity, transformation, and knowledge in this, at best, misguided system. For apart from inquiry, apart from practice, individuals cannot truly be human. Knowledge emerges only through invention and reinvention, through the restless, impatient, continuing, hopeful inquiry human beings pursue in the world and with each other. Teaching models are cool. They emphasize the lecture. The last reason, in my opinion, that education is flawed, and by the way, the people are what's important, too, said that day the debate it all clicked for me. There's so many people like him in debate for whom traditional education was never working because they were not in charge of it, and teachers were not listening to them and what they needed and what they wanted to talk about. But Melissa, we have a debate topic. We imposed that on them. Yes. And last year was hard. But I want you to know that those kids in the second year of the New York Urban Debate League, they felt it important. They knew where Kosovo was. And they listened to the evening news, and it made a difference all of a sudden. They understood what was going on. They were enfranchised into a new world of information that was a global perspective. It was out of the neighborhood. It was an opportunity to spark creative thinking. This year, what a gift, education, they're all experts. Every last one of them. And we need to tap into that. The third reason education is flawed is because, as Jonathan Kozol says, it is a rigged game. It is a rigged game. You have a student who is a Rhodes Scholar who reports the story. He says, in the process of taking this class, he realizes that his life has been ruined. Kozol has ruined this Rhodes Scholar because he has taught him that